From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Colonel Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Listen, for many years now, this show has completely been ignoring our listeners' taste, preferences, or good judgment. And frankly, it's worked out pretty well.
But that, Peter, ends today. This week, you, the listener, get to produce our show. Although you are limited by your raw materials, mainly us.
We asked you all to submit your favorite Wait, Wait moments for the last few years. What follows this hour is the result. Everybody wins. You get to hear the stuff you like best. We get to take the week off.
And we begin with the single most nominated Wait, Wait moment. It happened during a show we taped in Seattle in June of 2008 with panelists Paula Poundstone, Paul Provenza, and Adam Felber.
Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi.
Who's this?
I'm Paula Ewing. I'm calling from Denver.
Hey, how are things in Denver?
Beautiful. Hot.
Hot, really? Wow. Yeah. So the ski season is finally over.
Yes.
Molly, it's nice to have you with us. You're going to play Who's Carl this time. Carl Castle, once again, will read three quotes from the week's news. If you correctly identify or explain two of them, you win our prize. Ready to go?
Yes.
All right, here's your first quote.
Disappointed, backwards, unusable, totally confusing, pathetic, completely odd, weird, scary, slow, garbage, not usable, crapped up, crap, absolute mess, craziness, terrible.
According to Mac Daily News, those were just some of the highlights from a long flame email a couple of years back. It was describing the writer's experience using Microsoft Windows. In fact, this week, the author of the email got so frustrated he quit Microsoft completely. Who was it?
Bill Gates.
Yes, Bill Gates. This week, more than 30 years after he founded Microsoft, Bill Gates officially turns in his badge and cleans out his cubicle. He's now going to go try to make something of his life. Gates' departure from the software behemoth is not expected to result in any huge changes at Microsoft. They will still be an implacable force for evil. But on the occasion of his departure. Some people found this 2003 email. It was revealed in some court documents from the antitrust case. In it, Gates complains at great length with the most bitter frustration and anger, much like any of his customers, about his experience trying to use the Microsoft website to download software. Gates said, quote, "This site is so slow, it is unusable." Others pointed to his even more angry 1999 memo titled simply, "Clippy Must Die."
I've seen that video, them putting Clippy in a car. Hey, where are we going?
Who's Clippy?
One day, the engineers at Microsoft said, you know, the people using our products, they're frustrated, they're angry, but they're not insane with rage. How can we
focus their rage?
How about if just in the middle of doing something, an animated paperclip pops up on the screen and says, can I help you? What are you doing? Oh, can I see?
Jeez, there's a lot of trees out here. I don't think we're anywhere near Redmond anymore.
What is that, cannoli?
What are you digging? What are you digging? Can I help you dig? Oh, you got a baseball bat. Do you want to learn how to play baseball? Maybe I can help you with that.
It looks like you're digging a grave. Is this a business grave or a personal grave?
So he's an animated character that you didn't like?
Yeah, basically. We'll explain later.
You folks must love technology because many of you asked to hear this moment from that same show in Seattle.
Paula, perhaps a solution for our latest energy crisis, Slate Magazine published a scientific inquiry that seeks to prove that in the future, women will be able to power their iPods and other devices by harnessing the power of what?
Oh, my. By harnessing the power of, I don't know, jiggling fat comes to my mind.
So close.
Jiggling, yes. Fat, no.
Breasts?
Yes.
No!
Writer.
Wait a minute, is it just women or fat men, too?
Well, who knows how far the technology may go.
So already girls who feel inadequate...
now can't even watch TV.
Right, exactly. This is what I'm thinking.
They'll just have to listen to shorter songs.
Hey,
but the big girls will get to hear, like, symphonies. And
someday high school boys will leer at a girl and say, she could power Anna Gunn. See that girl over there? Couldn't get through Twinkle Twinkle.
Should I explain this or just...
Oh, yeah,
I'm going to explain this.
Yeah.
Writer Adrienne So. Her name is Adrienne So. She's writing in Slate. She says, quote, I've always found the concept of breasts bothersome. They will fulfill their intended function for about 3 of the 70 years that I have them. The rest of the time, they alternate between getting in my way and embarrassing me, unquote. So she decided to see if they could be put to some useful work. She talked to engineers who are working on ways to harness motion and generate energy.
I just want to see the patent that these guys have written out.
Ms. So discovered that in theory, you could construct a bra that captures the otherwise wasted energy of bouncing breasts and convert it into electricity to power personal devices, cell phones, iPods.
Pamela, that's not a stupid idea.
If you're Pamela Anderson, the nation of Columbia.
You folks must love technology because many of you asked to hear this moment from that same show in Seattle.
Paula, perhaps a solution for our latest energy crisis, Slate Magazine published a scientific inquiry that seeks to prove that in the future, women will be able to power their iPods and other devices by harnessing the power of what?
Oh, my. By harnessing the power of... I don't know, jiggling fat comes to my mind.
So close.
Jiggling, yes. Fat, no.
Breasts?
Yes.
No!
Writer.
Wait a minute, is it just women or fat men, too?
Well, who knows how far the technology may go.
So already girls who feel inadequate...
now can't even watch TV.
Right, exactly. This is what I'm thinking.
They'll just have to listen to shorter songs.
Hey,
but the big girls will get to hear, like, symphonies. And
someday high school boys will leer at a girl and say, she could power Anna Gunn. See that girl over there? Couldn't get through Twinkle Twinkle.
Should I explain this or just...
I'm going to
explain this. Writer Adrienne So. Her name is Adrienne So. She's writing in Slate. She says, quote, I've always found the concept of breasts bothersome. They will fulfill their intended function for about 3 of the 70 years that I have them. The rest of the time, they alternate between getting in my way and embarrassing me, unquote. So she decided to see if they could be put to some useful work. She talked to engineers who are working on ways to harness motion and generate energy.
I just want to see the patent that these guys have written out.
Ms. So discovered that in theory, you could construct a bra that captures the otherwise wasted energy of bouncing breasts and convert it into electricity to power personal devices, cell phones, iPods.
Pamela, that's not a stupid idea.
If you're Pamela Anderson, the nation of Columbia. Many of our stories, particularly in our listener Limerick Challenge, rely on scientific studies. In November of 2008, Paula Poundstone had had enough. And apparently so had you, because you wanted to hear this again. Here's Paula, along with panelists Adam Felber and Roxanne Roberts. Paula, a British psychologist, has determined that the best way for a man to attract a woman at a nightclub is to do what?
Show her money.
Actually, flash the cash.
Yes. Mm.
No. In order to do this correctly, one must wear a white polyester three-piece suit with a black shirt opened halfway to the navel.
Disco dancing?
Yes, but disco dancing specifically like whom?
Like John Travolta?
Exactly right. Dance like John Travolta. Women like nothing better than a man confident enough to strut his stuff Travolta style on the dance floor.
You know, I've really been suspect of some of the studies that you guys mentioned. Where did you get that study? Was it done by Mr. Cotter's class?
It must be true. We read about it on the internet.
Yeah. This is my problem.
I think it was funded by the John Travolta Sexual Attraction Foundation.
Yes.
You know, the San Diego Travolta Institute is a respectable organization. And they've proved many, many interesting scientific points over the years. This is just one of them.
Name another.
Another is that angels probably look like John Travolta. It's scientific fact.
So what the researchers did was they showed video clips of 15 different dance moves to women, and they asked their opinion about which is the most sexy, attractive, and they went for the John Travolta doing the hustle disco dancing from Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, but you made it sound like when a guy's in a bar. Carl, I'm going to ask for a judgment here. You made it sound like when a person was in a bar, what a man would do that would attract a woman. I got to tell you, if a man is in a bar and he gets up and begins to dance like John Travolta
to Lynyrd Skynyrd,
I think, okay. Let me just say, there's so many factors that can't be controlled here. What bar? Yeah, is it...
I think the distinction is that I would be highly suspect of a man who walked up to me wearing a three-piece white polyester suit. However, if someone actually had some good moves but was not wearing a three-piece white polyester suit, I might be more impressed.
You guys, have you seen Saturday Night Fever recently?
No.
It doesn't hold up that well. I don't know what we were on in the late 70s.
Well, I read a study that says it holds up very well.
This week, we handed the reins over to you so we could sneak off and go to the beach. It's an all-request show this week. Many of you are music fans. Okay, strike that. If you were music fans, then you would not have asked to hear this Bluff the Listener game from December of 2008 with panelists Tom Baudet, Roxanne Roberts, and Paula Poundstone. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Mike Gray from Waco, Texas.
Hey, Mike, how are things in Waco?
They're actually cold, believe it or not.
Yeah, well, it gets that way. Well, Mike, it's nice to have you with us. You're going to play our game in which you must tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Mike's topic?
Go ahead, Jack Frost. Just try and nip at my nose.
Are you tired of Santa? Do you see a red nose and want to paint it black? Well, we know just the thing to rekindle that Christmas glow. Each of our panelists will tell you about a new adorable holiday character that's been introduced this year in order to spread a particular brand of holiday cheer. Choose that real story, you'll win Carl Castle's voice on your home answering implement. Ready to play?
Yes, sir.
First up, let's hear from Roxanne Roberts.
Once a minor character in The Night Before Christmas, Vixen is now the spokes reindeer for a new Christmas campaign to prevent bad boob jobs. The animated vixen, sporting a red and green bikini and bodacious curves, is the poster girl for the California Association of Certified Plastic Surgeons, which has launched PSAs and billboards promoting responsible cosmetic procedures. Quote, every December, husbands and boyfriends buy bargain basement breast augmentation for the women in their lives, explained Association Chair Dr. Steve Cohen. We wanted to educate them in a festive way. In the 32nd spot, Vixen says, quote, Santa knows who's naughty and nice and who's sexy. If plastic surgery is on your wish list, make sure you're in the right hands, a certified professional.
Vixen, the sea cup reindeer. Your next story of a new kid on the Christmas block comes from Paula Poundstone.
The GM in-house magazine Motormouth carried a Christmas story last week to explain the auto company's peril to little ears. Sparky, the little car maker's Christmas wish. Sparky was a chief executive office of a major car company. The company was a magical place with lots of workers who put together big, big cars that they had such fun making and that took lots of gasoline, glug, glug. People loved to drive them. The big, big cars went like hotcakes. Then one day, gas prices went way, way up, and nobody wanted to buy Sparky's cars anymore. He couldn't pay the workers. The spending money in the whole world started to go away. So the brave little CEO went into his big airplane and flew to the North Pole to ask the Christmas elves for a $25 billion loan. But the elves had no Christmas spirit, and they sent Sparky away. He was so sad. He knew the economy of the whole world depended on his company. So he drove back in his big, big car, glug, glug, and he wrote them a note dotted with tears and put it under their tree. Dear elves, all right, I'll take only $15 billion for my company and only give me a dollar.
Aww. Sparky, the auto company CEO, and his Christmas journey. Your last story of a new kid in the Christmas block comes from Tom Baudet.
The American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, ACCCE, or ACC, this week unveiled their new holiday mascot, Frosty the Coal Man, in a nationwide effort to promote their oxymoronic, not really an alternative fuel. The rollout on their website features animated, bug-eyed lumps of coal singing this catchy number. Frosty the Coal Man is a jolly, happy soul. He's abundant here in America, and he helps our economy roll. Frosty the Coal Man's getting cleaner every day. He's affordable and adorable, and he helps workers keep their pay. There must have been some magic in clean coal technology, for when they look for pollutants, there was nearly none to see. Everybody sing, Frosty the Coal Man.
I applaud your Christmas spirit, everyone. All right. Mike, let me review your choices for you. From Roxanne, Vixen, the augmented reindeer. From Paula Poundstone, Sparky, the auto CEO. Or from Tom Baudet, Frosty the Coal Man. Which of these is the real story of a new holiday character to warm you on those cold, long nights?
Well, I'm going to have to go with Frosty the Coal Man. That just sounds so ridiculous, but there's so much stuff going on here in Central Texas with coal.
Right. You wouldn't put it past them. Is that what you're saying?
No, I wouldn't.
All right.
No, I wouldn't.
Well, to bring you the correct answer, we can do nothing better than simply bring you this.
Frosty the Coal Man, he's cleaner every day. He's affordable and adorable, and workers keep their pay.
That is catchy. That, of course, was the Frosty the Coal Man jingle from the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. Congratulations, Mike, you got it right. Well done. You're into points for Tom. You've won our prize. Carl Castle will record the greeting on your home answering machine. Well done, sir.
It was a pleasure.
Writer Michael Pollan has become a kind of evangelist of the natural whole foods movement. Apparently, many of you have dreamed of telling him off because you wanted to hear Paula Poundstone doing just that.
Pollan joined us in February of 2009 to play Not My Job. The other panelists were Tom Baudet and Mo Rocca.
Pollan began the feud when he tried to describe our dysfunctional relationship with what we eat.
We're very confused about food, I think, which, you know, which is weird. I mean, what other species needs experts to tell them how to eat?
Yeah. Well,
but it's been a good career for me.
I know.
It's
I can't
out.
Tell you how many times I've had to tell my dog to get his head out of the garbage can. So
all right. So what should we be eating?
Food. But it's very hard, actually, for us now to know what food is, because there are all these edible food-like substances now that compete with food in the supermarket. So a lot of the book is helping people distinguish between the edible food-like substances and,
right.
and the real
like,
food.
For example, one of my rules is food does not come with a prize.
That's good. That's, I'm going to use that one.
Wait, Cracker Jacks do, though. I don't understand. What?
Okay, but let me ask you something. One of the things that has made my life worth living is ringdings. And I feel that it is food. Are you going to tell me that's not food?
There's a few simple tests to figure out if a ringding is food or not. How many ingredients does a ringding have?
A devil's food cake, one.
Yeah. Now, see, right there.
Yeah. A creamy filling, yeah. two. And a rich chocolate outer coating. What's the matter with you?
I think I would look at the package next time. That creamy is not cream.
It C-R-E-M-E-Y. Creamy. What the hell's the matter with you?
But. There are, you know, there are special occasion foods.
And what do you mean special occasion? I said it's what makes my life worth living. Are you suggesting I save it for one day a year?
I wouldn't want to deprive you of your
well, you know what? You may know a lot about food, but you don't know the first thing about living, buddy.
Hold on. I actually wanted to ask you that. You've become this hero. You've become this hero of the whole foods, local foods, real foods movement. Is that a burden? Do you? I mean, if you ever want to eat a cheeseburger, do you have to go hide somewhere?
Well, I did. Shortly after I got to Berkeley, I was in Berkeley Bowl. And there are a lot of...
Berkeley Bowl, just for people who aren't blessed enough to live here.
It's a local supermarket which has wonderful fresh produce, grass-fed beef. It's your idea of hell, I think.
Oh, my gosh. Is it a co-op?
It's not a co-op. No. And my son, when he was young, really liked Fruity Pebbles.
I bet he did.
Oh, I love
and that was his Saturday, you know, breakfast. And I was actually reaching for a box of Fruity Pebbles. And somebody tapped on my shoulder, and it was this tall, bearded graduate student, and he said, and I'm like this, he said, I'm watching Michael Pollan shop for groceries. And I didn't go in that store again for many, many months. Another rule is don't eat any food that won't eventually rot. I had a Twinkie for 2 years. I owned a Twinkie that
Oh, you did not.
Really?
I did. I have it. I didn't bring it with me. I have it on my shelf in my office, and I would give it a squeeze every couple of weeks to see how it was doing.
Like Mr. Whipple.
And
that's not good for them.
And
you bruised your Twinkie.
Two years later, it was as soft and spongy as the day I bought it.
But if you unwrap it, you didn't unwrap it.
I didn't unwrap it.
All right. My problem, I try to teach my kids to eat healthy. Healthy food, but you get a cantaloupe and you don't know when it's going to come of age. You have no idea that period between when it's like hard as a rock to when it's smushy inside is about 10 minutes.
Right.
And ringdings. Sometimes you got to wake the kids in the middle of the night because the cantaloupe's ready. Your kid wanted Fruity Pebbles just so he could sleep.
Well, Michael Pollan, we have invited you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
Honest to goodness, if I had one of these in my home, I would never leave the bathroom.
So you're an expert on food, what we put into our bodies. And we were casting around for something you might not know anything about. And we eventually decided on the other end of the process. And nobody handles that better than the Japanese. We are going to ask you now three multiple choice questions about the latest high-tech electronic Japanese super toilets. Get two such questions right, you will win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is author Michael Pollan playing for?
He is playing for Linda DeSantis of Berkeley, California.
All right. Here's your first question. Leading Japanese high-tech toilet manufacturer Toto Corporation offered free repairs to one model after some of that model were found to do what? A, burst into flames. B, circulate water clockwise in the shameful Southern Hemisphere fashion. Or C, lower the motorized toilet seat back down too quickly, shocking and in some cases trapping male users who were just taking a little bit too much time.
I'm going to go with C.
You're going to go with C. They're just boom, ow, that. Well, you're right in that many of the toilets have motorized lids that go up and down by themselves, but in this case, the problem was they were bursting into flames. Yeah.
Doesn't that depend on what you eat?
No. These toilets are highly mechanized and motorized with lots of electronic components, and in this particular case, the bidet attachment was catching fire.
Yeah, but corn syrup can douse that.
Yeah, that's why it's important to have. All right, we have two more questions for you. Here's your second one, right?
Are they all about toilets?
They are, in fact, all about Japanese super toilets.
Okay.
Many Japanese public restrooms, already equipped with futuristic toilets, have upgraded them further with a device called the Sound Princess. What does the Sound Princess do? A, it plays a coaxing, gentle female voice to help men get their business done just by encouraging them. B, it simulates the sound of water flushing to cover other bathroom noises. Or C, it rates the strength of your urination by its sound as a measure of prostate health.
Oh, I'm going to say B.
You're going to go for B. You're right. It covers the sound. Japanese people, especially women, are reputed to be very embarrassed by bathroom noises, so these devices, the sound princesses, cover it up with whatever noise they choose. All right, this is exciting. One for two. You have one more question to go. Get this, you win. They're not done, Japanese toilet engineers. Just recently, a model went on the market with what new feature? A, a massage attachment that will reach up and rub your shoulders as you use the device. B, a personalized MP3 player that will recognize you by your weight and automatically play your favorite music. Or C, a remote control to save you the trouble of having to turn slightly to use the control pad.
I'm going to go with C.
You're going to go with the remote control?
Yeah.
You're right!
Hey!
Hey! Hey! Little remote control, so you can, you know, operate its features. By the way, the remote control on the new model has a big button that's labeled in English, stop. And the reason is because Westerners in Japan have had a problem. They don't know how to deal with these toilets, and there's been incidents of people being trapped on them or spraying water all over the bathroom, so they want to make it easier for Rigaijin.
A panic button on your toilet remote.
You know, you've given me an idea for a sequel.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go.
This whole conversation.
That's great. I'm so glad to help. Carl, how did Michael Pollan do in our quiz?
Well, Michael had two correct answers, Peter, and that's good enough to win for Linda DeSantis.
Well done. Michael Pollan is the author of numerous best-selling books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma. His latest is In Defense of Food. Michael Pollan, thank you so much for joining us. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We weren't quite sure at first why you wanted to hear this one again, but then we remembered Adam Felber's uncanny impersonation of a drunk Russian airline pilot. Here he is with Kiri O'Connor and Charlie Pierce in February of 2009.
Adam.
Yes.
Adam, passengers in an Aeroflot flight this week from Moscow to New York were a little worried when their pilot seemed obviously drunk. Mm. Strangely, they were not comforted when a representative of the airline told them what?
Not to worry, because the plane is mostly automated now.
That's what he said.
Yes.
He said, it's no big deal. Passengers began to worry when the pilot got on the loudspeaker before the flight to make announcements, and he was slurring his words. One passenger said of his pre-flight announcements, quote, it took him 3 attempts to say the words duration of flight, unquote. So the passengers started complaining. They said, this guy is drunk. You know, we can't have this guy fly. And airline officials came on board and said, yes, they did. They said, quote, it's no big deal. This airplane practically flies itself. Finally, the pilot, his eyes bloodshot, came out of the cabin. And he told everybody, and I swear this is true, he said, quote, look, I'll sit here quietly in a corner. We have 3 more pilots. I won't even touch the controls. I promise.
I sit here in a corner. You won't even notice me.
He's sort of the anti-Sully.
It was great. It was great.
Igor there. Over there, he's the designated driver. There's one on every Aeroflot flight.
I don't want to appear. Fly plane. Ignore me doing this. Someone bring me bucket and we take off.
So the airline did provide a new crew, which flew them to New York, but they deny that it happened. They say the whole incident was caused by, quote, mass psychosis on the part of the passenger.
They all imagined a drunk pilot.
They all imagined a drunk pilot.
Was all dream. You did not see me.
Please return your pilot to his original upright position. For later.
Thank you, everybody. You're very kind. This week, of course, it's an all-listener request show. Here's one from a few years ago. In June of 2006, late-night host Craig Ferguson joined us to play Not My Job. I started him off by asking him about his famous non-traditional monologues. Craig, for those, your show's on late, 12:30 Eastern on CBS. For those who haven't seen it, could you tell us about your monologues because you've become famous for them?
Well, what happens is that when I started doing the show, they asked me to do a traditional late-night monologue. You know, hey, you guys, how about those playoffs? What about those Yankees? And when I was talking about the Yankees, I had no idea what I was talking about. I thought it was the Revolutionary War. I was just, you know, reading out jokes. So I said, look, I'll do whatever's on my mind. I'll talk about what I want to talk about, and we'll see how that goes. And it seems to have picked up.
Right, you're not coming out and doing a series of bing-bang topical jokes. You're making these rambling monologues about, like you say, any topic at hand.
Yes, that's right. Television's better for that because I think it makes it more intimate. And at that time of night, most people are drunk.
That's
so,
true.
Or intimate.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Most people are being intimate. They're not paying any attention to what I'm saying.
So have you had to learn how to, because you grew up in Scotland, of course, we don't have the tradition of...
We don't have late night television. It's all turned off at 8 o'clock at night and everyone gets beaten. Hey, television turned off, let's beat everyone up.
But did you have to, like, learn the ways and mores? I mean, like, how to sit and chat with some starlet about her next movie that may not have come naturally to you?
Yeah, a little bit. Although I have instituted a policy of no one gets on the show unless I'm remotely interested in talking to them, which is a new idea apparently. But you know, they say, oh well, you know, some, and I won't name anyone, but you know, Tara Reid, for example, wants to come on about. I'll say, well, I'd rather she didn't. Can't she do it in someone else's, you know, show? She was on the show once, but you know, we both thought it was a terrible idea about halfway through the interview. And I threw it to a commercial, and I think everyone was happier.
Really? You did that? You sort of said, oh, we're going to take a break, and then, well, the camera was off, you turned to Tara Reid and said, I'm sorry, but I'm just not that into you. Is that what you did?
No, I didn't. I did it the Hollywood way. I said, we have to take a break, and then it went to commercial, and I said, you're terrific! And then I never asked her back, basically.
You had a career, Craig, as a stand-up, of course, before you, or maybe even as you came to America, and we looked into it. So tell me, Craig, about this Bing Hitler.
Oh, Bing Hitler was a character that I played early on in my career. Everyone was doing character comedy in Britain in the 80s, and I thought, I want a character who has a name that will stand out in a poster.
Yeah.
You know. So I chose the name Bing Crosby for comfort, and then the name Hitler, I thought, well, that'll get people's attention. And And it did, unfortunately. Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, did it in a good way, or did you get yourself in trouble?
Yeah, no, it was fine. Actually, the character was very successful. It was nothing to do with, you know, singing or fascism, but it was...
Which is a shame, because when you eliminate singing and fascism, what's left to do comedy about,
right,
really?
Because these are the building blocks of comedy. Without them, what can you do?
Exactly. You're stuck doing prop humor without fascism, really.
That's right. Without singing and fascism, everyone's carrot top. Where are you going to go?
Well, Craig Ferguson, we are utterly delighted to have you with us today. Now, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
You are the last organ grinder in New Jersey.
Excellent.
We saw a fine article in the L.A. Times last week about Joe Bush, who is... Well, he's the last organ grinder in New Jersey.
Right.
I'm going to ask you three questions about the life and times of a man who truly has a monkey on his back.
Right.
If you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is Craig Ferguson playing for?
Peter, he is playing for Mike Fangman of Burbank, Illinois.
All right. Here's your first question. Joe Bush did a lot of things in his youth. He was in a rock and roll band. He tried stilt walking. Why did he decide to become an organ grinder? Was it A, his friends said his big curly mustache made him look like an organ grinder, so why not? B, he was walking down the street when he saw a crank organ sitting in the trash, took advantage of it. Or C, as he put it, quote, I don't know, I'm just somehow drawn to tiny monkeys in hats.
I think B, he took advantage of a trashy organ he saw lying in the street.
Decided to make it into his living. I asked for that one, and it still took me by surprise. Isn't that...
I aim to please. I'm nothing if not a vaudevillian.
Okay. No, the answer, of course, was A, the big curly mustache. The corners
really?
Of his... Yeah, the corners of his... He's in the 1970s. He had a big curly mustache, and the ends of it started to meet down in his chin, and his friends said, hey, you know what you look like? You look like one of those hurdy-gurdy guys. And he said, well, why fight it? And that's what he became.
Well, why not shave it?
You know what's funny is the reporter in the article suggested that to him, and he slapped his head and said, oh no, now you tell me. All right, you two have two more chances here.
All right.
Next question. So, of course, he had made this decision to become a hurdy-gurdy guy. He had to go out and get himself a monkey. He did. The monkey's name was George. How did Joe begin the process of training George to be his partner? A, he fed George all the caramel popcorn he wanted until he became dazed and tractable. B, he tied himself to George all night, three nights a week until they got used to each other. Or C, he got an organ grinder monkey outfit for himself so that George would see him and want to imitate him.
This is a trick question, isn't it?
It is.
I want to say he got the outfit so the monkey would imitate him, but I think the monkey's smarter than that. So I suspect it was A, the other one that
I forgot. You fed George all the caramel popcorn?
Yeah, that one. Why not?
Well, sadly, it was B. He tied himself to the monkey all night, three nights a week.
Is that legal? I don't know if I like that.
This was in suburban New Jersey, where, believe me, anything goes.
How closely did he tie himself to the monkey?
Unclear. Well, they'd fight. He said he'd tie himself to the monkey. He'd turn in the TV so that it would cover the noise of them fighting, and then he and the monkey would go at it, hammer and tongs, all night, shrieking, yelling, whatever, until finally the monkey gave up and started cooperating with him.
But when you say tied himself to the monkey, do you mean there's a little kind of wristband around his wrist?
That would be my guess.
He wasn't, like, strapped flat to his body.
I don't think so. I don't think he wrapped duct tape around himself with the monkey.
No, that's
a baby Bjorn thing.
See, because if he had done that, I guarantee you the monkey would have won.
Exactly.
You gotta keep distance. Interesting to know what people are doing while you're working on late night television.
Exactly. Yes, the only purpose of your show, sir, is to drown out the monkey cry. All right, we're gonna leave Joe and George alone. They ended up having a wonderful career together until George died. He's now freeze dried and sitting on Joe's mantelpiece. Well, where else do you want him to be?
Is he still attached to the freeze-dried monkey?
No, I believe he cut the cord and moved on with his life.
All right.
Still performing with another monkey, but we have a historical question for you. one of the reasons that Joe is one of the last or the last organ grinder in the New York City area is because organ grinders in New York were dealt a terrible blow when Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia banned them entirely in the 1930s. Why did he do that? A, Mr. and Mrs. Astor insisted on it after a monkey climbed in their Fifth Avenue window during, quote, a marital moment.
Wow.
B, was it because B, the mayor hated organ grinders because when he was a kid, he used to get teased by kids shouting, "Hey, organ grinder, where's your monkey?" Or C,
right.
Reporters who had gathered for a mayoral appearance were distracted and eventually walked away to watch a performing monkey, and the mayor was mad.
I'm thinking A, it was the Astors in the three-way with the monkey.
I really have no one to blame for this but myself, so.
I mean, come on, you started it.
I know.
I think maybe the answer, but I think probably it's B, the other one that I've
B.
completely
forgotten.
The
mayor hated organ grinders because they used to tease him by calling him one.
Yeah, why not?
That's right, in fact.
Wow!
It had to do, of course, with anti-Italian prejudice at the turn of the century and the fact that Fiorello LaGuardia was pretty funny looking.
Yeah, well, you're going to be like that if you strap a freeze-dried monkey to your machine.
I can still hear their cries, LaGuardia wrote in his memoirs 50 years later. Hey, Fiorello, where's your monkey? Carl, how did Craig Ferguson do in our quiz?
Well, Peter, he needed at least two correct answers to win for Mike Fangman, but Craig had just one correct answer.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry.
It's all right. You know. You've got so much else going for you. This is a minor bump in the road.
No, I feel I've let America down. I'm going home.
All right. Greg Ferguson is the host of CBS's The Late Late Show. You can watch it pretty much every weeknight at 12:35 a.m. Eastern. Craig Ferguson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Lovely to have time with you.
With our Bluff the Listener segment, sometimes fiction is stranger than truth. And that seems to have happened with a game you wanted to hear again. It's from August of 2008 with panelists Roxanne Roberts, Charlie Pierce, Paula Poundstone, and guest judge and scorekeeper Corey Flintoff.
Hi, you're on Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hey there, Peter.
Hey, who's this?
This is Jim Stotts from Conroe, Texas.
Conroe, Texas. Where the heck is that?
That is one county north of Houston.
Can you smell Houston from there?
Unfortunately, sometimes, yeah. There's a prevailing southerly breeze here.
That's great. Well, that's nice, though. A little whiff of Houston in the morning. Well, welcome to the show, Jim. Now, you are going to play the game in which your job is to tell truth from fiction. Corey, what is Jim's topic?
If I find Andrew Weil, I'm going to rip out his beard one hair at a time.
Wow. So everybody is constantly offering us advice on how to live more healthily. Let's be honest, a lot of this stuff will not help at all. In fact, some of it is downright bad for you. Our panelists are going to tell you about three stories that clearly illustrate the unexpected dangers of healthy living. We found it in this week's news. Choose that real story. You'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine. Ready to play?
I'll give it a try.
All right. First up, let's hear from Roxanne Roberts.
British celebrity chef Anthony Worrell Thompson had a fantastic recommendation. Henbane, he said in August's Healthy and Organic Living magazine, is, quote, great in salad. Really yummy. Unfortunately, henbane, an old Anglo-Saxon term meaning killer of hens, happens to be a very toxic weed that causes hallucinations, drowsiness, seizures, and possibly even death. Thompson meant, of course, to say fat hen, a safe wild herb used for tea and salads. He told the BBC the mix-up was, quote, embarrassing, but one of those genuine mistakes. No reports of any casualties yet, but the magazine has posted a warning on its website. As always, check with an expert when foraging or collecting wild plants.
A lovely organic gathered salad that could kill you.
Ah.
Your next story of an unintended consequence of healthy living comes from Charlie Pierce.
The Broadway Pilates studio in Delafield, Wisconsin, was forced to destroy all its apparatus this week when students found themselves afflicted with a rash on the palms of their hands. Studio director Wendy Bendofsky mixed up a batch of moss-based organic cleanser from an old Native American regime, only to find that it reacted virulently with the material in the equipment causing the rash. Now all students have to wash their hands thoroughly under the supervision of the studio staff after each session, prompting Bendofsky to joke that the studio will change its name to Pontius Pilates.
Poisoned Pilates equipment in Wisconsin. Your last story of bad juju from too much tofu comes from Paula Poundstone.
Just say no to tea tree oil. Keith Richards was among the passengers on American Flight 72 from Boston Logan Airport to London Heathrow who got an unexpected free high despite the airline's recent cutback on perks. When she woke with a bit of congestion that morning, flight attendant Andrea Brandt applied Vicks VapoRub to her chest. Once at the airport, Ms. Brandt topped the VapoRub with tea tree oil, an herbal healing agent. This, investigators found, created an intoxicating aroma. Soon after takeoff, the fumes began to affect the passengers. It was a bit like heroin, really. It was slow and then bam, said Keith Richards. Pilot Jasper Byrne, secure within the cockpit, remained unaffected, but suspected something odd when strains of Beast of Burden reached him through the cockpit door. They were all singing. All I could think was, how am I going to get these buggers to put their seat backs forward, said Byrne. It was a bit like a hit of ecstasy, said Keith Richards. A jubilant group of 10 from business class donned their flotation devices and formed a conga line chanting, cut the engines over the Atlantic. It was more sort of like a bit of Quaalude with a vodka chaser, kind of how the top of your head comes off, said Keith Richards. The flight landed safely at Heathrow. Really hard to come down, said Richards.
No, Paula, go on. All right.
Was my story a little long?
It was, but worth every second, Paula. Yeah. It was fabulous. Jim, let me review your choices for you from Roxanne Roberts, a story about how a chef in a healthy living magazine recommended that the readers poison themselves with ingredients for an organic salad. From Charlie Pierce, how a Pilates studio became a toxic waste dump through the use of an organic cleanser. Or from Paula Poundstone, the story of how a flight attendant's experiments with VapoRub and tea tree oil ended up pretty much sending the passengers on a trip they had not expected. Which of these is the real story in the news this week?
Wow, that Keith Richards is just a never-ending source of amusement.
Isn't he, though?
Yeah, but I'm going to choose answer A because the phrase that was used in that one, genuine mistake.
Genuine
British mistake. Accent sounds the most genuine.
All right, so you're going to choose Roxanne's story about the poisonous herb being recommended for use in salads. Well, we spoke to an authority in this area to bring you the truth.
We would never consider using henbane on a menu at Alinea. It's fatal. Perhaps something like eye of newt.
That was Grant Akitz, who is the chef and owner of the award-winning restaurant Alinea right here in Chicago, who is explaining why he would do a lot of things, but he wouldn't put henbane in his salads because it's bad for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Jim, you picked the right answer. Roxanne was telling the truth. You earned a point for Roxanne, which I know is your greatest pleasure in this life. And you've won our game. Carl Castle will record the greeting on your home answering machine. Congratulations. Well done.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the National Association of Realtors, providing information for those buying or selling their homes at houselogic.com www.patreon.com/buyandsell. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need on the web at rwjf.org. And Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio. In association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug Berman, executive producer. B.J. Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Emily Ecton, and Eva Walchover. Our technical directors are Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to our panelists, all our fabulous guests, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR.